welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. This was one of my favorite podcasts to record in a long, long time. I'm going to be speaking with Dan Siegel today. And this whole conversation for me was a potent invitation into a new way of viewing the self and, in some ways, what the point of being alive in the world is. I really wholeheartedly encourage you to listen to this whole podcast. We're going to talk about the pandemic of the solo self, this mistaken sense of self that we have. And we'll talk about Dan's view of the self and how science is now backing up many of the realizations and insights from contemplative traditions. We'll talk about the formation of personality and wholeness. We'll talk about Dan's upcoming work inspired by his deep exploration with other scientists around the Enneagram and what insights that's led to. And we'll talk about the plane of possibility, how we can access and rest as this awareness of awareness. And as we do, that can allow for healing and integration and emergence to take place and lead to this feeling of wholeness. What's included in this conversation, I think, has profound implications for the work we do as coaches and the type of coaching that's emerging in the world. Dan Siegel is a pioneer in the field of interpersonal neurobiology. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the founding co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center at the UCLA. He's also the director of the MindSight Institute and is a prolific author, the author of numerous articles and many highly acclaimed books, such as The Developing Mind, The Mindful Brain, The Whole Brain Child, and many other books. And as you'll find, Dan has a powerful ability to communicate complicated scientific concepts in accessible and provocative ways. In some ways, this whole conversation to me felt like a pointing out instruction from a contemplative tradition. So let's dive in. Here is the podcast with Dan Siegel. So Dan, yeah, it's wonderful to be with you. How are you doing today?
Hey, Joel, great to be here with you. And I'm doing well. I'm doing well. So much is happening in the world and trying to be present for it.
Yeah. I think we'll probably weave that into our conversation, actually. And, you know, maybe this conversation could be an ode to lovers of integration as we just, you know, named as being people who listen to this podcast. So.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, whether a person is in coaching or in therapy or just a person on the planet trying to figure out how to navigate these challenging times, I hope our conversation will be of benefit for anyone listening.
So I think a good place to start, let's start on a bigger picture level in the sense of, could you say something about the view of the self that you hold? You know, I know you write about this, the pandemic of the solo self and this notion of mui and intra-connectedness. And so I'd love to talk about that and the science behind that too. And then we can talk about what that means for lovers of integration.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, it's kind of a simple idea, but it's an idea that sometimes doesn't come across people's kind of radar. But it's this four-letter word self, S-E-L-F. And it's the notion that however you identify the features that are going to define you, and those could be, you know, the sensations I have in this body I was born into. It could be perspective, you know, I'm wearing glasses, you know, through my glasses, through our point of view, you know, or even the agency, how we act on behalf of something. And those three things, you know, sensation, perspective, and agency, they're probably the simplest way of saying what we mean by self. And identity then would be the features we use to define what that self is, what its boundaries are, what its characteristics are. And, you know, even our sense of belonging emerges from how we identify the boundaries and characteristics of self. So it just started becoming clear, here's the simple idea, that in modern times, that word self has been equated with the individual. In just some absolutely taken for granted ways. So we have beautiful terms like self-understanding or, you know, self-regulation, you know, in my field of research, that's, we study self-regulation, or in the broader field of contemplative practices, we have the beautiful work of Kristen Neff in self-compassion. And these are all great uses of the term self, but they really imply the individual. And so it's natural in linguistic terms to say, well, yeah, well, self does mean individual. Well, what is this even question about? You know, what are Joel and Dan talking about that they would even question that? So for me, it just became like, whoa, what if these defining features of your sensation, perspective, and agency didn't have to be limited by the boundary of your skin encased body? Like, could you have a sense, like between you and me right now, Joel, that there's a dyadic, a double, a layering of a pair that comes up, or anyone listening to us, the three of us, the listener, Joel, Dan, and then what if it got extended to everyone listening, or everyone interested in integration, like you point out, or all of humanity, or all of nature? Then there'd be a sensation to that. There'd be a perspective to it. There'd be acting on behalf of all humanity, acting on behalf of all of nature, the agency. So then it just started becoming like this dawning moment years ago, like, what if we've had a case of mistaken identity? Like, what if we define self as the individual? And while self is really important, it's not limited to the skin, that it's actually this layering. We have like an identity lens you can shift. So then if that were true, that we had a case of mistaken identity, then the question was, maybe that's the root cause of so many of the ills that we not only face in modern times, but that we're creating in modern times. And then the exciting idea is, if that's the cause, well, then maybe that's the intervention. Stop the mistaken identity of self equals individual, which you can just name as the solo self, you know, this self only defined by your skin encased body or bodies that look like yours. You know, that would be like a plural solo self. Anyway, so that just became an idea that I started just pursuing intellectually, trying to look at the science of that, looking at the indigenous teachings behind it, the contemplative teachings behind it for thousands of years that have been saying that kind of thing. And science is only catching up to indigenous wisdom and contemplative findings from deep reflective practice, that when you sit alone on a cushion, you come to realize the you that's in the cushion is not the limit of the you that actually exists. You are, you know, in many ways, the whole of nature. So that set of consilient, you know, which means common ground, that consilient set of findings, the common ground across contemplative teachings from thousands of years in different traditions, indigenous teachings. So I'm here on the land of the Chumash and the Tongva, where this was the teachings for thousands of years. And when you look at independent indigenous cultures, they have had the same teaching. So science is just catching up with this old wisdom. And at the same time, modern culture tends to, or used to anyway, listen to science. Now there's kind of a pushing away science. Oh no, it's just a matter if you're an influencer, that's all that matters. But I think there's a validity to science offering something to build on indigenous and contemplative invitations from thousands of years ago to say, let's wake up from this nightmare of mistaken identity. And I think the hopefulness I feel is that if this has been an unidentified fundamental, if you will, like a splinter, then the reason we're limping through life is we have a splinter in the sole of our foot. Then if we can identify the splinter, which is mistaken identity as a solo self, remove the splinter, then it can heal and we can begin to walk in a beautiful and balanced way.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm thinking about many of the audience and the intention of coaching and therapy, and actually so much of the interventions are based upon a view of what the self is. You know, and if we have a mistaken sense of self, then we're maybe playing in a very small territory of what's possible, or maybe we're never going to have the kind of impact that people are actually looking for. So,
yeah, well, exactly. And sadly, there may be, yes, not getting the impact you're looking for. And number two, unintentionally reinforcing the problem. So the take, for example, the field of mental health. You know, I'm not a coach, but I am a mental health practitioner as a psychotherapist, a psychiatrist. And, you know, I think my field, the field of mental health, for the last 100 years has been misguided because they define the self as separate. And, you know, while there have been really great inroads in certain areas, in other areas, you know, there's been absolutely little progress. And part of that is in the loneliness people feel and the isolation people feel, and the lack of belonging people feel, and the increased levels of anxiety, depression, drug addiction, suicide. So, you know, those are indictments about a field of mental health that, while it may say, well, we're modern, I think my field, mental health, we have, you know, based it on exactly what you're saying, Joel. You know, let's help the self, the mind of the self, get better, you know, get to mental health. Well, first of all, they don't say what the mind is or mental health, but that being aside, you know, they do define the self as the individual. And that, I think, is a fundamental, not only error, and I'll say this, you know, not trying to be hysterical, it's a lethal lie. Because when people try to live a life living out that statement, because it's wrong, they desperately get on a hedonic treadmill to get more and more and more things to kind of feel good about life, because they've defined the self as the individual. So the individual's got to get as many toys as possible before that individual dies. And then you're on to the races of, well, I have 100 units of things. That's not enough. I better get 1,000. I get 1,000. That's not enough. I probably need 10,000, Joel. Help me get 10,000. Now you get 100,000. I'm still feeling something's wrong. Now I get 1,000,000 things, you know, and to get the 1,000,000 things, I have to start producing stuff that you buy. And if I can get you to buy it, then maybe I can get 10 million things or 100 million or 1,000,000,000 things. But I'm getting you to buy all these things for your individual self because you feel this sense of inadequacy, and on and on and on it goes. And that's called the hedonic treadmill. And so you're constantly trying to make up for this feeling of an emptiness inside. And, you know, this last book I just finished a couple of days ago is called Personality and Wholeness in Therapy. And it's going to be really interesting when it comes out to have group conversations, because it addresses this, you know, and asks people to look deeply at our evolutionary history of how the brain works. And it's a long story, but it fits with everything we're saying. It's just an added dimension of the story.
Maybe we could tease that idea out a little bit more, because it seems like there's a shift in worldview taking, and I hear that in what you're saying, from atomizing the self, you know, a world of parts, you know, fixed parts that are in isolation in some sense, and can lead to this sense of disconnectedness and loneliness you're talking about. And, you know, I hear people talking about how relationships could be seen as being more fundamental than the parts themselves. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about relationship and the sense of interconnectedness, and how that might relate to wholeness as well. Because my sense is there's a sense of well-being that can come from entering into wholeness, not just as an idea, but as a felt experience, where suddenly we feel satisfied on a level, and we can connect on a level. I mean, and open to how we're made in formation with others in a way that's kind of quite profoundly different. So yeah, I'll just let you take that where you feel like taking.
Well, I love that, Joel. I mean, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, we have a couple of things that have become very active, I think, in people's minds. You know, one is, as you point out, the idea of parts, and Dick Schwartz's wonderful work in internal family systems that we can talk about. The other is something that's existed longer than that, which is the Enneagram system of personality. The Enneagram of personality builds on kind of this mathematical and philosophical notion of these 9 points on a figure. But then Ochauzo and Naranjo created this system of personality applying the Enneagram to that. So I'll just use the word Enneagram, meaning the Enneagram of personality. And I learned about that about 20 years ago, actually. And it seemed both intriguing and a little daunting because there was a whole mystical world behind it. And I'm a scientist. So that journey involved me getting to know four other science-trained people who are also interested in the Enneagram. One of them was a major teacher, David Daniels. And it was with Denise Daniels, his daughter, Laura Baker, her colleague at USC, and Jack Killen, who was at the National Institute of Health. So the five of us for 20 years on and off were working together until David died in 2017. But once he passed, you know, at his funeral, actually, one of the leaders in the Enneagram world came up to us and said, "So are you going to let this project you've been working on die because David died?" And we kind of looked at each other. We said, "Well, we have to. I mean, he's gone. But, you know, we wrote a chapter in a book about this, but, you know, he's gone. How can we?" She says, "You can't let this die. You cannot let it die." She kind of looked at us with these very compelling eyes that Helen Palmer has. And anyway, so we said, "Okay, well, let's see what we can do." So we spent the last 5 years, actually, now it's really 6 years since then, or more, actually, 7 years, getting this book together, and we just submitted it. So, and it'll be out next November, this coming November. So I just say all that to say that, you know, as a scientist, participating with these other scientists was really interesting because we took on the whole world of the Enneagram from a science lens, which the Enneagram is not. But we think there's something really powerful in the Enneagram of personalities. That's the first thing. We had 50,000 narratives that David had accumulated through an organization called the Narrative Enneagram. So we had access to all that data, which was really cool. We had David's writings as well. And then the other thing we had was this whole field of interpersonal neurobiology, which I work in, you know, where we have, you know, dozens and dozens of textbooks, and we have all the science about how the brain and relationships interact to shape who we are, and some of my own books as well. So, so there was this rich, empirical, science-based view of development that we then tried to see if there was anything that correlated with the Enneagram of personality. And we searched this way, that way, nothing seemed to work. And then we found it, something we think works. Now, it could be completely wrong, but at least it matches, like, completely with these thousands of narratives we have. So that was interesting. So then we put it together in a book, and I was at the helm of finalizing that whole way of translating these ideas into language. And what is interesting about it is we took on the word that you're bringing up, wholeness. And we were nervous about it because, you know, people can use that word in lots of different ways. So we really wanted to come to the linguistic term wholeness in as scientifically grounded a way as we could. So we spent a lot of time thinking about it, reflecting on it, playing with wording. And ultimately, you know, the way I wrote it up in the book is it has the feeling of wholeness, has the feeling of completion. It has a feeling of being connected. It has a feeling of being coherent. It has a contentment to it underneath wholeness. And it also, related to consciousness, it has an experience of kind of presence, of this open, spacious capacity to hold in awareness whatever's arising, all those features being ways of describing it. And so in that sense, it's an ease of being that in some ways everyone is on a lifelong journey to try to, and you can use a verb either try to achieve, or you can use a verb like get back to. You know, there's a whole model, which I don't know if you want to get into it, Joel, but it's a model that basically, whether you're talking about the Big Bang before anything existed, there was just potentiality, or more recently when you're in the womb, you know, you were just hanging out in the womb. There was no separation between you and the womb. So you're in that sense at one with the womb. And you didn't have to do anything. You know, all the nutrients you needed came through your umbilical cord. You know, you didn't have to breathe. You didn't have to eat. You didn't have to make sure someone was protecting you. you were just being, and that simply being state gets embedded in something called implicit memory. So in the last 2 months in the womb, you're laying down memory in the nervous system. So you're encoding it, you're storing it. And the thing about implicit memory that's fascinating is when you retrieve it later on, it is not tagged as I'm remembering something from the past. It just has a feeling of familiarity, which is a really important research finding about implicit memory in its pure form. So we think everyone's got basically an implicit memory in its pure form of wholeness. And when you come out of the womb, however you get out of the womb, now you're out, it's so different. The contrast is so stark. And not only is it different, but you've got to work for a living or you're going to basically die. It's a do or die situation. You have to breathe or you die. You have to eat or you die. You have to pee and poop if you die. You have to be protected by other people that you have to depend on or you die. So, and that's actually pretty much true throughout life. So this do or die working for a living setup is a huge contrast to just simply being whole and just being at one with the womb. So our view is that triggers an aspect of temperament that can go along the lines of, if you remember ABC, one system beneath the cortex, the subcortical area is for agency. That's the first system. Another is for bonding and another is for certainty. And some people may be a little more sensitive in one of those areas, but a small sensitivity at the beginning can lead a certain network to get a little more active. As it gets a little more active, let's say by a week of life, it's now in its activity, strengthening its own sensitivity. And then by a month, it's like even more. And then by a year, it's even more. So there's a reason to think that most of us, at least from our research so far, seem to have one of these three vectors, we call them agency, bonding, or certainty, as their jam. You know, it's their where their go-to, their baseline. There may be, you know, small percentage, 10% maybe, where they're equally distributed. And that certainly physiologically makes sense that there would be some people like that. But the vast majority, somewhere between 70 and 90%, can locate themselves in one of these three. So that being said, then you have a search for wholeness that involves agency, you know, trying to really deal with the issues of your body and having this oomph coming from the gut, this kind of, we call it an alif, an anatomical location of energy activation and flow, the newest acronym to put in the list. And this alif, you know, is different for these three vectors. So the alif of the agency vector is like a gut oomph feeling. The alif for the bonding vector, which is where you really are all about relationships, is really in the heart. And there's interesting physiological reasons to see it there and up above your diaphragm, in your chest, especially in the heart. And then, you know, for the people in certainty vector, their alif is, you know, the anatomical location of energy activation and flow is in the head because they're busy predicting and trying to get ready for what's going to happen next, which is a cortical thinking thing. So you've got like the cortical thinking and the certainty folks, you've got this kind of heartfelt sensation, you know, in the bonding folks. And then the one that have a baseline of agency, it's this gut feeling, you know, that comes out with a big energy to it. So we've been really excited to say that, you know, in the journey, whether you're a coach or therapist or just a parent raising kids or teacher or whatever, the journey to help people, this model, you know, it builds on the Enneagram personality. Of course, that's where our tens of thousands of, you know, narratives come from. But it's distinct from it because it talks about a developmental perspective. It talks about the brain, talks about relationships. It talks about this big contemplative issue of the drive to wholeness, even in meditative practices, may in fact involve this very urge to say, oh my God, I'm in a body now, which, you know, from a physics point of view is this Newtonian macro state kind of entity that feels like it's separated across time and space. But awareness, the experience of consciousness, the knowing of consciousness, I think taps you into a quantum realm that is what physics has demonstrated is in the microstate world, where there are no entities of noun-like separation in time and space. In fact, the time variable doesn't even exist in the quantum realm. You have simply massively connected relationality of verb-like processes. So, you know, the contemplative view in the last two chapters in this book, especially the second to last chapter in this book, you know, I originally had it in the middle, Joel, and then I said, you know, there are going to be people who roll their eyes and go, I don't believe in this quantum stuff. So I said, you know something, I'm going to use my own need for people being open to this. So I moved that to the end. And I said, look, this is the end of the book. You've gone through all the details in the beginning without what I'm about to say. But everything I just said gets a whole different flavor with this chapter. But you don't need to read this chapter. If you don't like this stuff, just reject it. Everything is still relevant. But if this is true, then you get this whole view that links indigenous teachings, contemplative teachings, even Enneagram teachings, coach work, therapy work, parenting work. It kind of, that chapter sort of ties it all together. So some people may not like that, but I found it very exciting to think that you could find its consilience.
I mean, that's incredible. And, you know, in one sense, I'm like, wow, there's so many questions I could ask about what you just said. I think what I want to ask you is but based on everything you just shared, therefore, what do you advocate as a kind of way of being or a move we might make? You know, if we're on this kind of impulse or drive towards wholeness, how can we be with ourselves in our situation that can kind of, you know, align with that or enhance that journey? And I guess the sub question would be, you know, is it different for each of those different categories of people, agency, bonding, and certainty people?
Yeah, such beautiful questions. So I would start with the I think exciting perspective from this PDP, which is Patterns of Developmental Pathways, is what my colleagues and I have named that. That in some sense, we begin in wholeness, and wholeness is always your birthright. And these vectors, agency, bonding, certainty, are how you respond to the fact that you live in a body, you know, and now you're out in the world in this do or die situation. So we kind of, by necessity, no matter how great our parents are, we move away from wholeness because you're in a body now and you're literally just trying to survive. So then there's another layer which takes those three vectors and turns them into nine, which is where you get the Ennea of the Enneagram. It means nine-pointed figure. And that's where you have this, I named it a tendency, which is the tendency of your attention to be either inward, you know, energy going inward, or outward, it's going out from your body, or kind of this weird shimmering. I shouldn't say weird because this is kind of my baseline, but it's weird in the sense that it's like a tension between inner and outer. It's not just, oh, I have inner and outer. So we named it dyadic. Like there's this really interesting, I'll use the word interesting instead of weird, you know, this really interesting tension between inward and outward as they shimmer back and forth. So I was once in a massive moment of doubt, that wondering even if this book would ever get done. And one of the issues that was coming up at a birthday lunch I was having with a friend, I was bemoaning how, you know, we had seen in the narratives that the people seem like they're inward, people seem like they're outward, and other people seem like they're both, but we couldn't find any research to support that. So we made a hypothesis, maybe there's an aspect of temperament that is this a tendency business, inward, outward, or both. But I'm really worried it's like way out there because it's, no one had ever described it. And it was like, you know, going out, we were already out on a limb anyway, but way out on a limb. So she looks at me and she goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, there's this thing, a tendency, inward, outward, or both. She goes, didn't you read my 2013 paper? This is a brain scientist, Mary Helen Imordino Yang. I said, I don't know, maybe I did, but what does it say? She goes, I showed in the brain, some people are inward, some people are outward, and some people have this. And then she uses the same language I had used in the book, in the manuscript, shimmering between inward and outward. I go, you got to be kidding me. So she actually found it just in the brain studies that she had done, putting people in scanners. So then I took a deep breath. I said, okay. Then we got to trust our observational data from the narratives and see how the brain functions. I knew it was theoretically possible, but I didn't know anyone had ever shown it, but Mary Helen had shown it. So when you add that, then you realize, yeah, so once you kind of say, you know, you're an inward agency group, let's say, that has a certain way of living that creates what we call adaptive strategies that we describe in great detail in the book. So those adaptive strategies are, as you're saying, Joel, specific to each of the 9 patterns. Mm. And the pattern would be a word we'd use for the present moment. So in the present moment, I have this pattern of how my emotions are, how my thinking is, how my behavior is, which basically is what we mean by the word personality, is emotions, thinking, and behavior that repeat in enduring ways in different contexts. And so that person's challenge to get back to wholeness will be different from someone, let's say, who's a, you know, a certainty vector outward. You know, they, in some senses, they couldn't be more different, you know, in many ways. The certainty vector outward has got a whole different set of adaptive strategies given their temperament. And so their journey to wholeness involves a very different set of things. But in the end, coming to your first part of your question, in the end, this is what's so exciting, I think, about this PDP perspective. In the end, wholeness is wholeness. And in a way, you come to realize that personality is putting you asleep. Personality is like keeping you from a common ground of wholeness. So we all have different personalities. Sure, and we're all unique and there's billions of us and all that stuff. Sure. But ultimately, you know, and in the writing, I call this the plane of possibility in lots of different books. But ultimately, when we get back to that plane of possibility, in terms of how do you live your life, that you're in a body for some part of a century, you get to live in it. You know, for me, what's been very helpful is to say, okay, well, you know, the Big Bang let potentiality emerge into actuality. A sperm and egg got together as incredible potentiality that became this actuality of this body called Dan. I pop out of the womb. I've got this struggle to get back to a feeling of wholeness, whether it's being at one with the womb or, you know, being in the Big Bang's potentiality place, or if it's an awareness in this plane of possibility where I've written, I think that's the source of being aware, is when the energy position is in this plane of possibility. And then I get really, really relaxed. And, you know, I do the Wheel of Awareness practice every day. And so I tap into the hub, which is the same as the plane of possibility. So, you know, I want life to go well. I love the people I love, and I want, you know, the world to get better from all its suffering. And at the same time, it's not or, and at the same time, I feel this deep sense of peace that the portal for integration, which is the source of well-being to arise, is this plane of possibility. So I don't have to make stuff happen. I am responsible for trying to access the plane of possibility and live from that plane, not live in it, but live from it, lead from it, learn from it, love from it. And that's all my responsibility is. So it takes the pressure off in many ways that I don't have to construct anything. I need to let that personality stuff get out of the way. So I become more like a conduit, like a hose through which integration can naturally arise, because I am tapping into the plane of possibility. It's not me making it happen. The plane of possibility is something we all share. So I'm just letting my personality get out of the way and saying, that's why I'm here on Earth, is to try to tap into the plane of possibility, be a conduit through which integration can arise. And I don't know how that's going to happen. Every day something's going to happen. I'm on now, Joel, with you, which is wonderful to see you and be with you. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's not my job to know, even though I'm in the certainty vector, which is how my personality would get in the way. No, it's my job to tap into the plane of possibility. And what arises from there is integration. And you know, we say integration made visible is kindness and compassion.
I feel really thrilled hearing you say this, because the conduit has been a metaphor and archetype which has been very meaningful to me in my own work as a coach, in terms of Why I feel so thrilled is because I see this emerging in the coaching field as well, where it's a style of coaching which is dropping a change agenda and actually instead including what is emerging in experience or what is unfelt or unseen, allowing that to emerge into awareness. And then integration starts to naturally happen as we allow things to be as they are.
Yeah,
And
beautiful.
then experience begins to unfold, and integration and healing occur. And actually, I've seen this with many people is, and then they just fall into this sense of wholeness. And often you have to kind of say like, is there anything missing right now? Or, and then they're like, oh, no, there isn't. And
Yeah,
they
exactly.
like, they really tune into that feeling of wholeness. And they're like, so I've had people say like, wow, this is what I was looking for. So actually I'm connecting some dots as you,
Oh,
because
that's
I remember one person in particular, it was almost like he was saying, this is what I've been looking for since I was in the womb. He just didn't say that, but this is what I've been looking for, but I didn't know it. It's like, but I know it. Now I'm here, I know it. So I really connect that to your idea of the implicit.
Yeah, Joel, that's so exciting to hear because it is a kind of shift in whether you're a coach or a therapist or a parent or a teacher. It's a shift that says, and I know it's probably perennial wisdom that is wisdom been taught through lots of different practices. So it may not be new, but there is a science behind it that just is really exciting to add to that, thousands of year discussion. But it basically says this. It says that complex systems have something called emergence. And emergence is where the interaction, the elements of the system give rise to something larger than the elements themselves. So it's very much like what has been called synergy or synergetics by Buckminster Fuller. Something greater than the individual parts is what the whole is. So if you've been told a lie that your self is separate, then right away you're starting to put all your emotions, your thinking, your behavior, your personality basically, around this lie of a separate self. So by defining the self as separate, you've actually taken the systems view. Oh, emergence comes from the interaction of the parts, and you've mistaken the part for the whole. And so you go, oh, so this body, that's myself, and I've got to make sure this body does everything it's supposed to do. Well, that's a pathway that's never going to work. No matter what you do or earn or anything, it's never going to work. So the difference then is a huge shift to say the emergence of complex systems says there's a property called self-organization. And this is a property whereby when aspects of the system are naturally able to differentiate, that is, be different or distinct or individualized, and to then naturally link, that is, connected and become associated with each other, mutual influence. This balance of differentiation on the one hand and linkage on the other, in math, they don't have a name for it. So I just named it integration years ago. So integration is the balance of differentiation and linkage. And it is the way complex systems optimize self-organization. And they achieve this kind of harmony that emerges. It's flexible, it's adaptive, it's coherent, meaning it holds well together over time. It's energized, it's stable. That spells the word faces, flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. That faces flow is probably the closest we're going to get to defining mental health, but it's also what wholeness feels like, right? And so the faces flow arises from integration. And then you say, well, when integration is impaired, what happens is you go to either chaos, rigidity, or you go to both. So it wouldn't be either. You go to chaos, rigidity, or both. So that is a fascinating thing because mental suffering, when you're far from wholeness, is experienced as chaos, experiences rigidity, or both. And so then you can say, well, oh, then the whole thing fits together. That when someone's blocking integration, they're blocking the faces flow, they're tending to go to chaos or rigidity or both. And then what happens is you are stuck using strategies of development that continue to excessively differentiate identity as the solo self. And so you think, oh, I got to do more for this self, more for this self. And then what it does is it just increases the blockage to integration, and you get further and further into the chaos and rigidity. So what's so exciting about the shift that we're talking about, and Joanna Macy may have called this the great turning when it comes to our modern culture, is that you are inviting a turning away from the false notion of self as individual, and saying we have an identity lens that can be up close. So you say, I do have a body. Sure, if you're hearing this, you have a body. But it can be widened to the relationships of people you know, it can be widened further to the relationships with people you don't know, all humanity. It can be widened even further to all of living beings, to all of nature. And so we can realize that the identity lens, like a camera, is something people don't realize they have. So we don't want to get rid of the self. This is like not going from me to we. This is where, as you mentioned, the word mui, you know, says, no, let's not get rid of the individual. Let's just say the individual is one aspect of what your identity lens can see. The spa of sensation, perspective, and agency can be narrowed down to the body. Cool, that's fine. You've got a body. Enjoy your body. You know, exercise your body, stretch your body, feed your body, take care of your body, sleep your body. Yes, 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 yes. Understand your body's history. Absolutely. So we're not getting rid of that. So that's the me. But we're saying that if you think that's all you are, not only you, but all of life on earth is going to be threatened. So why not also say who you are is we? So you say, well, which is it? Am I me or we? And this is where the funny word we comes up, because you say you're both. You are in the body. And you're all the relationships with people on the planet. That's the we. So taken together, that's mui. And that's the fun thing about mui, is that it gives people a linguistic simple term to realize they don't have to choose. Am I an individual? Or, you know, in some of the contemplative traditions, there is no self. Well, that's wrong. There is a self. Mm. There absolutely is a self. The problem is we've narrowed down defining it by the skin encased body.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could, it's so ingrained, you know, I can see that we would need a shift in education of young children to broaden out this sense of self, you know, in an appropriate way. But there's a lot of history here that needs ingrained, this sense of the skin encapsulated self that needs unwinding.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is the both challenge, and it can feel overwhelming for sure. But if you think about it, if you just ask a simple question, like to a kid, who are you? And they go, oh, I'm Joel, or I'm Danny, or whatever, you know, you go, okay, yeah. That's a part. Great. That's true. And who else are you? Oh, I'm my family. Good. And who else are you? Oh, I'm my pet. Yeah. And who else? And, you know, kids know this.
Yeah.
But then they're taught to forget it.
Yeah.
And that's where the lifelong journey to wholeness is, you know, something that is letting go of the lies you've been told and releasing the natural way people feel this wider sense of who they are. Take, for example, going for a walk in a forest. People start getting healthier out in the forest. Why? You know, because they realize they are the forest.
Yeah.
You know, and when we close down identity, we really restrict this capacity for integration, because we're excessively differentiating and we're not linking.
And, you know, it's not just a conceptual sense of saying I am the forest, but, you know, through practices like the Wheel of Awareness that you named, actually having a kind of felt experience, a perceptual experience of communion with the forest.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what comes to mind as you're saying that, Joel, is I went to a forest called Pando Populous in Utah, in the United States, the state of Utah. And I was with 50 religious leaders, and we went into this grove where there were about 48,000, you know, aspen trees, right? So it's Pando Populous is the formal name for the quaking aspen tree. So the person leading this group of religious leaders and me, I'm not a religious leader, but I was asked to come along, you know, asked me to do the Wheel of Awareness in the grove. And the steward of the forest was there. And so he had never meditated before, but he was up for it. So all these folks, the steward of the forest, the 50 leaders, myself, I'm guiding them through the Wheel of Awareness, and we do it. And part of it is, you know, the hub of the wheel, the metaphoric wheel, is the knowing of awareness. The rim are the things you have as the knowns, and you move the singular spoke around. And so we did the practice, and you can do it on my website, and we have lots of people do it. So we did it, and then people shared what they experienced. So the steward of the forest ranger, he speaks up. He goes, I've never meditated before, but when I bent that spoke around into the hub, and I felt so connected to everyone, I felt such at peace, such joy, such love. He goes, that feeling in the hub of the Wheel of Awareness is exactly why I'm here as the steward of this forest. Because people come here and I walk them around the forest, and there's 48,000 aspen trees and stuff. But when you go 6 inches beneath the surface of the soil, you find out it's one root ball. And we've tested the DNA in all the extremes of this forest, and it's the same DNA. It's one tree. These are 48,000 trunks of one aspen tree. It's among the oldest and largest living things on Earth. And everyone was like quiet. And I'm like, going, what? And he goes, this is why everyone should do this meditation, the Wheel of Awareness, because that's the feeling in the hub that this forest is trying to remind people that we're all connected in that spaciousness of that, the hub of the wheel. And, you know, when you realize that, then you realize these bodies are like the appearance of separate trees, but we all come from a common root ball. We are one essence.
And that's what I'm feeling right now. I'm feeling the felt sense of that, you know, that story about the forest plugged me into just what you said now, like we're coming from the same essence. And
yeah, when you say you have the felt essence of it, can you expand on that? Because I'm feeling it too with you right now. And so can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, sure. It comes with a sense of like awe, a sense of like vivid communion, almost like the feeling of something blooming into being, and it's intimately shared. Like we're intimately sharing that.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That sharing, that awe, that expansion of a self, not so much transcending a self, but letting yourself expand. Imagine if that felt sense could be an invitation to have other people feel it. And certainly now we have the concept, we have the science, we have the indigenous and contemplative teachings. Yes, yes, yes. If it doesn't include this kind of gnosis, you know, and noesis, right, this deep felt sense of things, as well as the conceptual knowing, you know, then we're not going to make a change. So even in this short little conversation you and I are having, you know, less than an hour, we can bring each other to realize this deep essence we all share. And how we can creatively do that in the world, whether it's at home with parents, schools, with kids, you know, out adolescents, if we could do it on social media, that would be amazing. If we could do it in corporations, if we could do it in governments, it's really, it's almost like just waking up from the nightmare of mistaken identity of the solo self as being who we are alone, you know, the individual equals self, and just waking up from that and say, okay, you know, we made a mistake. This felt sense you're so beautifully describing, Joel, is the starting place where you know in your felt sense what is the truth. And now it's just finding avenues to invite people into this kind of waking up process, you know, and there are different ways of doing that in different settings. And so there's no like one size fits all, but there's absolutely, I believe, this conversation is something you can hold in your heart, hold in your gut, hold in your head. So whatever vector you have, your personality challenging you, inward, outward, and both, you know, dyadic, you know, all these ways, it's an invitation to say, wow, that is the work of our lifetimes, both in the individual body's lifetime, but what's facing humanity now, it is absolutely the work of this moment in human cultural evolution, that the human brain has constructed an erroneous definition of self equals individual, and it's time to wake up from that lethal lie.
Amen to that. I can feel the quality of gnosis that you talk about, where the conversation has taken on an entirely different feel to it, you know, and there's a kind of almost like a feeling of truth, beauty, and goodness or something, and an inherent value in what's being expressed, as well as an important message. And I'm just imagining if people were able to access this and from here make important decisions about how we collaborate or, you know, live sustainably, that it would be a very different experience. And I want to ask a question, which is like in my awareness, and I know we don't have long left. It's a little bit of a shift, but not much. But you want to say something?
No. I'm just I'm happy to be here with you. You're seeing a smile on my face. That's just a feeling of contentment and wholeness.
It connects to what we were talking about with the you know, agency, bonding, and certainty, and then the different ways that, you know, that can be kind of expressed. And you mentioned IFS as well. So, you know, there could be a tendency for people to see those, I think it's like kind of looks like nine types or as kind of personality types, and then they might see them as being fixed. And, you know, I see that with internal family systems sometimes, where parts can be seen as like nouns, fixed. And how can we hold those types you described in a different way? Or, you know, how do you see that with IFS?
Yeah. So those are two really important aspects, I think, of how to dive into the questions. You know, from an Enneagram point of view, some traditional Enneagram teachers teach from the view type, T-Y-P-E, you know, that it's a like a categorical, this is your type, you're in that, you know, you're left-handed or right-handed, you know, which type are you, or, you know. And so our group, the PDP group, we actually see these personality things, let's just call it, use the word things, as verbs, not the noun-like type categorical way of dividing them up. So we see them as verb-like unfoldings that have a kind of enduring quality to them. So we can understand why people would attribute entity-like features to this enduring verb-like process of, let's say, a vector outward or whatever. So the way we handle that is just really talk about patterns, not types. And that over time, you're on a pathway of your life that is both kind of a pathway of what's been shaping you over time and also a pathway in the brain. You know, so understanding these beliefs, these, you know, areas that are these anatomical locations of energy activation and flow is super helpful. And then understanding all these adaptive strategies. So, you know, we hold the noun-like view of personality very tenderly, because if personality is problematic, it can be noun-like and fixed. So ironically, part of the journey to wholeness is letting go of experiencing and expressing personality as a noun-like type and actually open up to patterns. In terms of internal family systems work, and Dick Schwartz and I are friends, and we've had lovely discussions about this in various settings, you know, both public and private. So I can just say, you know, that I think internal family systems is a brilliant way of inviting people to know the truth that the mind has lots of states. So from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, we would see them as states of mind, which include both neural networks that are involved as well as relational communication patterns that are involved, because the mind is both fully embodied as well as fully relational. So by calling them states of mind, you're able to see that the mind is not just inside that it's skin encased body. And this is really helpful from, we have 9 domains of integration. One of them is state integration, probably the most relevant for IFS. But we have 8 other domains that we dive into. But for us, state integration has always been very much like what Dick Schwartz has written about internal family systems, that you need to understand different states, these verb-like processes that are embodied and relational, that have enduring qualities to them. And so if they think they're now like fixed entities, that can be when there's problems. And so a stuck, quote, part from an IFS point of view may believe with its survival tenacity, I must be a noun or my survival is threatened. And in my work, you know, working with people with dissociative identity disorder, you know, which is a post-traumatic aspect of disorganized attachment, you know, yeah, they come in absolutely experiencing themselves with names and noun-like parts that are separate, for sure. So seeing them that way is an example of unresolved trauma in my clinical experience. But when people start getting healthier and healing and integrating, the noun-like aspect that was a kind of a shell that was a way of surviving becomes loosened up. And there's this beautiful verb-like embracing of everything we've been talking about, Joel, basically today is, I am a part of a much larger thing than this bodily self. You know, I am a part of all of humanity. I'm part of all of nature. And that verb-like, deeply connected emergence of energy flow patterns basically allows you to have this freedom, because while it may have been frightening to go to uncertainty, which is what the plane of possibility is, my experience both in workshops and in clinical work is when people start embracing this uncertainty, they're open to the verb-like nature of energy. Because after all, there are no nouns in the brain, and energy flow has no noun-like aspect to it when you look at the quantum features of it. So it's only when we get stuck do we believe there are noun-like, you know, types of personality or parts of the mind or whatever. And so seeing these as verbs is more than just an academic discussion. It's actually part of the healing is to move into the verb-like fluidity. And I say that with all due respect to the Enneagram folks, to IFS folks, because I know there is a lot of energy put into the noun-like view. And, you know, I've had people yell at me and go, we are nouns, we are nouns. And I respect that feeling, but in my clinical experience over 40 years of practicing as a psychiatrist, you know, when people are holding on to a noun-like view of their lives, of a fixed entity, it actually reinforces its own fundamental problems. And so opening to a verb-like fluidity is actually part of the journey to wholeness. But how's that sit with you, Joel?
Yeah, I know we've got that seeming noun-like quality to the part can actually allow it, when you see it as a verb, to actually integrate.
And
I think that seems key here, in that if you always see it as a noun, maybe it's more difficult for it to fully integrate. And I know we have to go, but so then just in a sentence, I'm wondering, like, how to be with those states of mind so that they begin to flow. Is that where kindness comes in, as a kind of being with in a accepting kind of way?
Yeah. I mean, the being with and accepting is a beautiful way of saying it. And I think this may sound super nerdy and strange, but ultimately, you know, we are energy flow. That's it's all energy flow, right? And when energy gets condensed into matter, you know, equals mass times speed of light squared. So these bodies, even we live in, are energy. It's just has a commitment to a certain form for this 100 years we're around, right? So it's all energy. Even matter is energy. So that's been established. So once you say that, then you go, okay, well, if it's all energy flow, what's it all about? And then you could say it's all about releasing the verb-like nature of energy from its false view of being a noun-like fixed entity. And then when you do that, there's this freedom and fun that arise. And when you allow that plane of possibility, that massive location of uncertainty, to be your home ground, then you kind of let these personality views, or, you know, parts views, or all this stuff, you let it go, and you allow this deeper sense of basically you are love expressing itself. Because love is what that plane of possibility is all about. And after doing this with tens of thousands of people, the Wheel of Awareness, the most common word people use for that hub of the wheel, one of the most common words besides connected and joy and, you know, wholeness, the main word is love. So it's almost as if love is the fabric of the universe. And I say this as a scientist and a clinician, you know, what that means is you want to live from the plane of possibility. You want to live from love. And that's a verb-like, massively linked, connected, beautiful way that the force of life can be expressed through you, and with quotes around you. And you realize that you are this verb-like, massively connected conduit through which love can really light up the world.
Exquisite, exquisite. I mean, this is a beautiful place to round up our conversation. What a poetic, I mean, I'm really bowled over by this conversation, Dan. Thank you so much. And
thank you, Joel.
I'm so touched by it. I'm sure it will be touching the people that listen to it. Where can we find out more about what you're up to in the world?
Oh, boy. Well, the two websites, one is, if you want to do the wheel, go to DR for Dr. Dan, D-A-N Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.com. And if you want to jump into our community courses and stuff, it's MindSight, M-I-N-D-S-I-G-H-T, MindSightInstitute.com. And come join the community.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.